Folks, your program notes will indicate very briefly the background of the next speaker. May I say sociologically that our next speaker is 6'7", and any normal American of that altitude would, as a responsible patriotic American, almost certainly have headed for a multi-million dollar career as a basketball player. But he decided instead, in some of the darker days of recent years, to what some might say, waste his time. His talents, that of communicating contagiously, benignly so, but contagiously, a fervid, analytical, somewhat humorous, but always relevantly humorous, analysis and affirmation of our purpose in Vietnam, as I've heard him many times. And if in a free society, words count, as in a closed society, words corrupt, and if any one man has tilted the axis of the planet on this particular envenomed issue, let me say as a senior citizen that the tide that swept over us throughout the arts and the culture of our society from 1965 to 1979 or 80 is turning. That tide of self-indictment of our purpose in Vietnam is beginning to turn. And if in that vague abstraction public opinion there's a slow gelling, oh, however slow, but it will quicken. And if it quickens to our satisfaction, one of those at the shore who built the dike in the first place and is now able to reverse that tide is this altitudinous, remarkable American, Dolph Droege.
Thank you very much, Murray. Coming on this platform with the conference three quarters over, with every speaker hitting a home run, I am a designated hitter who probably isn't needed. But I want to do some things today that, and everything I mentioned today about Vietnam will have come from what I said at the times that I spoke on the issue between 1967 and 1973, so that there is no, we're not trying to say, oh yes, now we know. There is one thing I did not know, and I will open with that, and that is a shocking disclosure that General Vo Nguyen Giap, the defense minister of North Vietnam, made in March last year on French television, which was referred to last night by Arnaud de Boeschrab. But what General Giap said is to a team of French journalists, let us talk reality. There was no liberation front. I sent the army. We sent our North Vietnamese army into South Vietnam in 1959. By 1961, we had 30,000 of our North Vietnamese patriotic heroic troops there. We won the war. There was no liberation front. It was not even created by communique till 1960 in the sense that they were going to announce it. And 1961, in fact, when it says, well, it happened. Now, my point is, it's late in the hour of looking at Vietnam, and certainly we have seen by a television documentary of 13 hours that perhaps no matter how much time you give people, unless they understand the context of events, they are never going to be able to escape from the prison of their own one-eyed nature of looking at problems, because that's certainly what the television documentary is. It's meant for people with one eye who can sit down and watch a very small set and get half a message and leave nourished only in the sense that they are more convinced than ever that everything was hopeless and everything was wrong. But note now, what would happen if an American official of the stature of General Giap revealed that an American program had been worked out before any American involvement in Vietnam had taken place, let's say Korea, that this revelation would be by an American general or defense secretary, well, yes, we met in Korea, and we planned to go into Vietnam. We had to work that out, and it took a long time to get us in there, but we finally found an excuse. Now, if that statement was made, no matter how remote a television crew, perhaps Medicine Hat, Wyoming, and a small local affiliate, when the defense secretary retired, was really off guard and thinking of his own retirement plans, they would never give up on publicizing that all over this country. Well, now it can be told. Here it is. There would be symposiums. There would be demonstration. There would be congressional investigations just on that statement. There is no attention given to the great dismay of General Vo Nguyen Xiap, because he really wanted some credit. He's thinking of his memorial library to be, and nobody's paying attention. It was run as a small, thank God we have the Washington Times. It was run in the Washington Times in an editorial. Now it can be told, the lie set straight. The Washington Post referred to it in a little squib, if at all. And no one ever got the film. Here in this great television world where we're rapacious to get anything that's on film, nobody's ever gotten the film here. It's never been shown on television. It was not included in the series. Of course, it couldn't be in the first showing of the series. But where is it in the repeats? Wouldn't it be nice to start out with at least one more North Vietnamese identified by his own fervor who said, you know, I did it. Hey, folks, you're looking for the villain or you're looking for the hero? It's me. They didn't want the intrusion into the issue of a mere defense secretary or minister of defense of North Vietnam. The story is set, sealed, and delivered. Now, that's news. And that's new, and it makes all State Department white papers an exercise in modest understatement. So we now, they were not only accurate, they just couldn't be emphatic enough. That isn't referred to either. Okay, now we go into a look at what has been said during this conference and the subjects covered, which still, because of the way the television documentary of those 13 hours were presented, still need facts that were so available that, as we heard this morning from Harry Summers, this was so much on the record, it was hard not to find it. The things I'm going to mention, the Carnow book gets close to mentioning. It's a much better balanced book than the television series. One wonders, how can something be born from a petri dish of a book and emerge totally misshapen and not related at all genetically to its parent? What happened in the process of going to television? For instance, why was it not important to say Ho Chi Minh had 21 aliases before he took the name Ho Chi Minh? Would that sell some newspapers if I said that a candidate for office in the United States, now running for office, had actually now approached us with his 22nd alias? Well, I think I could sell some papers on that. But no one mentioned this, except it is set forth rather methodically in Stanley Carnow's book by listing the aliases. Not perhaps all, but it's good. But it never got from the page. I would imagine Carnow, the author, must be outraged by the damage done to Carnow now on television film. I don't think he feels that way. I read his little letter to Reed. He said, I'll stand on the issue. So it obviously is apparent he's never seen the series. But now, Ho Chi Minh took the names to change. Now, he did leave his country. He was just a youth. He left in 1912. He born Nguyen That Thanh. Okay, first, Nguyen will be victorious. He leaves his country in 1912. His father's arrested. He's on his way. He goes to France. He's in Marseille. Then he goes to South America. Then he goes to Boston. Then he goes to New York and Harlem. He lives in Harlem for a while. Then he goes to London. Not a bad start for a good movie. Could be Warren Beatty on a half shell here. In London, he's a chef's assistant. Then he goes to Paris, 1914. He's a photographer's retoucher. And the most dangerous thing, he's a poet. Poets are dangerous in Vietnam. Poets are dangerous. Ho Chi Minh has a name, many names, but one name is Nguyen Ai Quai. He is approaching Woodrow Wilson's door in a rented top hat and tails. It doesn't fit too well. This romantic, dark-haired, revolutionary student leader, in appearance, that's what he looks like. This man is turned down by Woodrow Wilson. Can't get in. We're too busy. Got 14 points, got the thing whole set up. No time. He wanted 15 points. He said, freedom for Vietnam. You cannot say a word against Ho Chi Minh at this stage. He is a young man in search of a means to achieve an end. And then he joins the French socialist movement that we heard. But he does more. He becomes a founding member of the French Communist Party. So who is Ho Chi Minh? Essentially, what did this series say about Ho Chi Minh? It was beautiful. After 1925, the events in Ho Chi Minh's life become rather unclear. Wait a minute. That's when they really get clear. He's a French communist, and we had a beautiful discussion from Dr. Kang yesterday. Dr. Kang took us right through 1922, 23, 24. By the way, I'd never heard that before. He has a book. It's out on the table out here right now. I'll flog his book. It's out there. You get that book. It's about the years from 75 to 80 concerning Vietnam, or 82. But he told us how Ho was picked up. Ho said at the Baku conference, when everybody said, revolution now, all over the world, communist revolution, Ho said, no. We must first have a national revolution and turn it into a communist revolution. The Soviets said, now there's a scholarship. Ah, there's a grant. I got a grant for that guy. So out came Lenin's Guggenheim impulse. And he brought Ho to Moscow. Now, Moscow is rather rigid, so Ho wanted to conform, so he changed his name to Leonov. He was a Soviet citizen with a Soviet passport. Hey, that's kind of exciting. That might make good television. The guy became a Soviet citizen. Then, in 1925, graduating from the Toilers of the East School, he's sent on assignment with the Comintern, as was said here, and he goes to China. He goes to Borodin in Canton. And now we turn to Huang Banqi, who tells us from the inside, because he served with this man in terms of Ho Chi Minh's movement. He was the director of the Mint in Hanoi. The man you saw sitting here built a hydroelectric station out of imagination to run the power, to print the money, to support the effort against the French. He looks like Ho Chi Minh today. I'm sorry to say that, Huang. If you're not careful, Hanoi will claim that it's not too late. All right, now, when he goes to China, you get the test. Okay, now, all this is just education. We all get educated, whatever, the scholarship, government grant, whatever, where we are. What is our allegiance? He invites Vietnamese to study revolution in China. This looks good. There can be Ho's revolution. He can take over. That's wonderful. And as they come to China, they deposit two pictures. One picture with the registrar in Hong Kong, Lum Bun Tu, and the other picture is reserved. Now that he goes, the students come to Wan Po Military Academy. Chiang Kai-shek is an instructor. Chou Enlai is an instructor. This is exciting stuff. Some of Americans in television actually know that Chiang Kai-shek and Chou Enlai are personalities. So here's their early days, and they're teaching at Wan Po Military Academy. And here comes little Ho Chi Minh's classroom trek of students. When they don't join the communist movement, however, mysteriously, a photograph that's been held in reserve is sent to the French security police in Vietnam as these students, now graduated, try to return home. So nationalists don't make it. When they deal with Nguyen Ai Quoc, for this is now his Vietnamese name, Nguyen Ai Quoc tends to be a person that after you get the grant from him, then you don't go communist, you get picked up. Now, what was the conclusive act? Well, he was given his first political education about fighting against the French by Phan Boi Chau, the leading nationalist of Vietnam. You'd have to go back and talk about a grand old man of the Vietnamese nationalist movement to get past the grandeur of Phan Boi Chau. And he said, come to China. And Phan Boi Chau came out of Vietnam, and he went to China, to Shanghai, and Ho lured him to the French settlement in Shanghai. They had all these little slices of PX holdings called international settlements, where every country had their own superimposed extraterritorial rights, and so France owned part of Shanghai, as did Britain, as did Dutch, as every... Okay, Ho gets him to go to the right house. The French own that house. The man walks in, hello, I'm here for dinner. You are the dinner. Phan Boi Chau is returned home in chains. Ho gets paid off in gold. He uses the gold to form a party in China, and the protest of the party in the streets is, we protest the inhuman arrest of Phan Boi Chau. Now, you're dealing with a pro. Right here, we can see. What you've got is a litmus test of, was Ho a nationalist? Now, is Ho going to abandon this in 1945 because Harry Truman sends him a gift? No. He's dedicated. He's a Leninist. He knows what he wants. He wants a communist Vietnam. He has a problem. No Vietnamese likes communism. It's a little impediment. Confucian, Taoist, Buddhist, ancestor veneration, Catholic. There's no room for communism. Can't work it in. They've got to sneak it in. Ho's version, never say you're a communist. Very simple version. Now, what I'm saying is, all this is on the record. How did PBS not see it? Well, it took a mighty act of will. We heard from Harry Summers what it takes in terms of strategy and war. This is a political war, a political revolutionary war that is carried out by Ho Chi Minh and his followers and those who are dupes or useful idiots. And it takes a mighty act of will to keep from stumbling over these facts, because they flourish like crabgrass, on the record. Okay, what I'm saying is, Ho was doing great. In 1928, Chiang and Mao started to kill each other. That is, each other's followers. That's what you call disharmony in the ranks. And Ho had to flee China with the Russian consulate in, or the Soviet consulate in Canton, leaving. This is their evacuation. They didn't have helicopters, but they were on the roof, and they got out in a hurry, and they went back to someplace else. Moscow is the best guess. But Ho didn't go to Moscow. He went to Thailand, eventually. Whether he came from Moscow to Thailand is not known because we don't have his travel vouchers, but we know he was in Thailand, and there he called himself Old Chin, and his head was shaved, and he was a Buddhist priest. Marvelous. Instant Thai. Now in Thailand, he's waiting, and Moscow likes to make use of their people. He had the same attitude McNamara had during the Vietnam War. McNamara said, make use of every aircraft twice a day. If you take a bombing raid, you got to bomb twice. It's cost effective. Well, Moscow said, what do we got this guy sitting in Thailand for? The whole Vietnamese communist movement is fragmenting north, central, and south. Get that. Now, this is another great fact that came out of the series. They failed to get the basic thing straight. There are not two Vietnams, right? There are three Vietnams. I hate to do this to PBS. You know, it's going to take another 13 hours. Because the Northerners are those people in that rice bucket Red River Delta. And then you have this long spine. This long spine comes down the 20th parallel to the 12th, runs all the way to Cam Ranh Bay. That's Central Vietnam. Aha! And then there's South Vietnam. South Vietnam is that rice bucket at the end of Mekong Delta. Okay. Now, what do they say about each other? The North Vietnamese. We are the Vietnamese. That's D-A-R talk. Central Vietnamese are scorned by North Vietnamese. North Vietnamese are political, they're cunning, they're cold, they're always sweating plots. They want power. Now, you know how these stereotypes are. South Vietnamese are the California people of Vietnam. They only got there in 1800. And they just, you know, you gotta throw the rice in the ground and jump back in the South. And what does the North say about the South? Hicks. Incredible Hickville down there. But the South say, but you know, watch out for the Central Vietnamese. They plot, they conspire, they sit up nights making lists of people they hate. You know how stereotypes are. What do the Central Vietnamese say about that? First, they don't say, they act. Every leader in Vietnam that personified this 13 hours of the PBS series was Central Vietnamese. Diem was Central Vietnamese, son of the Grand Chamberlain of the Emperor of the Court of Hue. Thieu was Central Vietnamese. And of course, Ho Chi Minh was Central Vietnamese from Nghe An province, the province of the wooden fish. They were so poor in Nghe An province that they liked to have a fish with their rice, but they couldn't afford it. So they put a little wooden fish in the bowl with the rice. And when the Nuoc bomb soaked in, you've got to experience Nuoc bomb soaking in. I lost my sinuses in Vietnam. When the Nuoc bomb soaks in, you eat the rice and suck the Nuoc bomb juice from the wooden fish and put the fish back in the bowl and say, clean it up, we'll eat it again. In that province, that's the province of revolutionaries, that's Central Vietnam. Did it ever say on this documentary that the only thing divided by the Vietnam War in Vietnam were the two parts of Central Vietnam? That North Vietnam never ruled the South in 4,000 years of history, which is what lawyers call lack of precedent. But, you see, without that information coming through, what did you have the picture of? A country thirsting for northern control of reunification. They never ruled. Once a southerner conquered the North. For 62 years, there was North, Central, and South all together, once. And then the French came. Missionaries fell on their knees, then they fell on the Vietnamese. Well, this... No, the missionaries brought cannon. They brought cannon with them. The French army arrived behind to protect the missionaries. And the French, you know, by the way, the French stumbled into Vietnam, too. They were looking for rivers to China. And they just couldn't find a river that went to China. But unfortunately, as Vietnamese say, all the rivers went to Vietnam. Now, they were true. The French had no interest originally, but they just got bogged down in trying to get to China. Land of the great PX. Now, what I'm saying is Ho Chi Minh was summoned up from Thailand in 1930 to go to Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong is a place where British police are looking for Nguyen Ai Quoc. He's on the Surete's most wanted list. They don't want him on the Donahue show. They want to arrest him. And he has to go into a city where the security will be British allied with French, and you'll have to hold a party convention to found a settlement of a quarrel between three quarreling branches of the Vietnam Party. How do you do it if you're Ho Chi Minh? I mean, if you're in Nguyen Ai Quoc, we'll use his right name there. Obviously, you do it in public. See, a covert society knows so much about being covert that they admire the open. An open society knows so much about being open, they admire the covert. You'll always find us trying to do things behind the barn. And you'll always find the North Vietnamese doing things in public, with fronts and all kinds of galas and marches and demonstrations. Now, he has a great idea. Why not go to a soccer game and hold part of the convention in the stands of the soccer game during the game? Try this at the Super Bowl. This is going to be very remarkable. Petitions are passed through the soccer stadium because this is the founding of the, now get this name because it is critical, Indo-Chinese Communist Party. Who would ever use the term, if you were born in Vietnam, who would ever use the term for a Vietnamese nationalist party of Indo-Chinese? What term does that denote? That is colonial. That comes from France. They invented that term. That's totally fiction. There is no Indochina. There's Vietnam, there's Laos, there's Cambodia. They had tense relations with each other in history, you know. The Cambodian ambassador would constantly say, Cambodian official would constantly say to the American ambassador in Phnom Penh, I don't really think that we can cooperate with the Vietnamese. No, can't do that. Well, we were thinking of solidarity here. This is the effort of the war years, and we're trying to keep the communists from taking the country. But the Vietnamese, you see, they've stole so much from our country. Mm-hmm. In fact, we owned all of them. Oh, and they kidnapped our Royal Ballet. They did, when? In the 15th century. You know, this person should move to Kentucky. They love those grudges like that in Kentucky. Now, Ho forms the party, Indo-Chinese Communist Party, because he's a French communist. Then he's a Vietnamese carrier of French communism, and he's a Comintern agent. Okay, he gets away with it. Party is formed. He says, Moscow, I did my job. And now we come to 1933, and Ho is caught. Trapped. All this is set forth in Carnot's book about the capture. He's captured. It's a thing where he's leaving the country, and they extradite him back to the country. They catch him, sort of like he's on a plane, he can't go anywhere, get him in customs and bring him back. And the story is he was flying to Singapore. Okay. He was returned and put in jail, and the French were hurrying over as fast as they could get there to take charge of their prisoner. This is the famous Nguyen Ai Quoc. And while he's waiting, he talks to the jailer. Now, Ho has lived in Harlem. He's lived in New York. He's lived in Boston. He wrote for the New York Herald Tribune. Ho has learned everything everywhere he went. So he says to the jailer, when in the course of human events, he quotes the Magna Carta. He talks about King John. He talks about the basic rights of mankind. The jailer starts to tear up. My God, you have such knowledge. What is going to happen to you again? They're going to kill me. Oh. You know, this is like Tom Dooley with the three PhDs in the folk song where they're going to hang him tomorrow morning. And the jailer says, I can't let that happen. You're too much of a human being, an educated, intellectual human being. Unique jailer. You have to go back and try to do a profile on this man. And he let the guy out and said he died and put Ho on a freighter. Ho slipped away. He allowed him to get to a freighter. Ho slipped away and his death was reported. Now, here's the point. In a series with 13 hours to research, why couldn't they have gone to the files of Le Humanité, which published an obituary notice on its front page in Paris saying, our dear comrade, founding member of the French Communist Party, French Communist brother, Ho Nguyen Ai Quoc has died. That's right there. A lot of Vietnamese in Vietnam just sighed with relief. Whew, boy, at last, I'm glad he's gone. How many has he betrayed? My God. So did Moscow. Izvestia. They put the obituary notice in. Is that hard to find? Can PBS actually be summoned up to go back? See, these aren't then things of just somebody's recollection. It's on the record. Now, why didn't they do that? Because it clashed. Even Karnow, who takes it to that point, he doesn't say that. He doesn't really go into that about the obituary notices as far as I can see in his book. But he goes to the brink of it. He said, well, Lin Ho got away, and then he did many other things. He sure did. He went back to Moscow. He was in the Purge Trials balcony in Moscow when Stalin killed the Soviet general staff. He was seen there, reported by an East German. He helped organize, according to other communists, he helped organize the Thai Communist Party, the Malay Communist Party, the Indonesian Communist Party. He was busy. For 8 years, he was dead, however, and that was a great advantage. If you have something on your record that's troubling you in your resume to upward mobility, die for 8 years, you will be refreshed. He takes his name after he's captured in 1941 trying to slip in and out of China and Vietnam. And he's a Chinese businessman. And they put him in jail. And in the jail cell, the guards taunt him, and he takes the name Ho Chi Minh. Ho, who is determined to enlighten. Now, you see, now he's a new person. And when he stumbles out of that cell, because he volunteers to Chiang that I'll lead a revolutionary movement of Vietnamese anti-communists. Got to get him anti-communist, right? Chiang's candidate died, and the warlord that was holding Ho didn't know who Ho was, and Ho said, I would help out any way I could. And they made Ho the choice. And he came out, and the OSS grabbed him in 1944. He had malaria, tuberculosis, and pneumonia, the big three of Chinese prison life. He did not look like Muay Quoc. And we saved him from his pneumonia, and we believed what you saw, and the series says, Ho was on a silver platter. Well, Ho was almost in a coffin, but we finally got him to the point where he could function. Now, Ho was very interesting because he asked for basic things. Give me a picture of Winston Churchill. Give me a picture of Franklin Roosevelt. And some guns. Now, why did the OSS get him? Now, this didn't come through in the film the way it should have. We had pilots down in North Vietnam, Allied pilots flying out of China and elsewhere. It was now World War II, and we wanted to get them out. Isn't that ironic? American prisoners or pilots or evasion escape candidates, we want to get them out. So Ho's going to get an escape net set up. And he goes in, and of course Vietnamese see him, and they say, you know, you really look kind of older, but somehow you look a little like when I clock. The Rat Fink of Vietnamese nationalism. And he said, I'm Ho Chi Minh. Don't you trust me? Roosevelt, trust me. Churchill, trust me. Here's the pictures. I mean, the man was clever. Okay. What my point is, all this was on the record. Why didn't they put it in? It would have clashed with the picture. Here was the Vietnamese nationalist. He was ours for the taking in 1945. No. He was ours for to be exploited by him to get the Chinese out of North Vietnam, which we heard so graphically. All right, onward, onward. Ho dies in 1969. He only has then a few years after the American entry into the war in Vietnam. Note what was missed in the PBS summary. Ho sends the clear message to the South with a poem 25 days before the Tet attack. All Vietnamese rise. Once in a thousand years, all Vietnamese rise. This is called the wake-up call. All units are told they're going to attack. We heard the poem, but we didn't know exactly why Ho was writing poems again. But it was out there on the radio, and Hanoi had problems. What were the problems in Hanoi? Well, China just had a nervous breakdown. I don't know if you know what it is like to live underneath a perpetually pregnant China. To have had 15 wars with that China. To have this massive ally and maybe problem of future conqueror right above you. But the Chinese were in their Cultural Revolution. It started in 1967. Full swing. That meant all of China for 10 years would be in a total state of nervous prostration. Ammunition trains and supply trains coming across China were looted by the people who went crazy in China. The Red Guards shot the people who hadn't read the Little Red Book quick before they read it. The factory workers shot the Red Guards. The college students lived in the streets. And that was the kind of mob scene that took over the supply trains. Now this is the supply train. This is the umbilical cord for the war from overland.
And of course, there was also the Sino-Soviet quarrel since 1960, when Khrushchev yanked all Russian aid out of China. That's growing all the time. The two major PXs are having a bigger quarrel than the client that they're helping. All that was passed up by the documentary. So there was no context. Now, if China's going through this nervous breakdown, you better attack while you still can attack, because in 1967, something happened accidentally in South Vietnam, and the PBS documentary misses it totally. Village elections were held in Vietnam in 1967 against the advice of the Americans who were looking at this election problem. Get your president, get your vice president, get your parliament. But the Vietnamese said, yes, and we'll elect villagers too, village leaders too. Well, you know, I wouldn't go too far on this. This is a war out there. No, the Vietnamese said, it's very important. What they meant is, in 1600, the emperor of Vietnam told the people, look, I'm in a bigger primary than you all are. I'm chosen by heaven. You've got to choose your village leaders. I can't get inside your villages. You elect them. And they did. And they kept on in that position. And even the French preserved that. And in 1956, it died because Diem wiped it out. That was his major mistake in 56. It wasn't in the PBS documentary. Now they put village elections back in. And then, as you heard this morning, they armed the villagers. Now who's got a problem? Move now or find out that you won't have a Chinese pipeline. And can you move in the future against people armed to defend the land they've just received? You see, you got 2,300 villages in Vietnam. We couldn't get to 1,000 at that time. Tet attack came. You saw the Tet attack. Okay, you saw the pictures this morning, and we had a marvelous discussion as Peter showed those films. But remember, only three Marines guarded the doorway of the American embassy. They were attacked by 26 sappers who went through, the demolition specialists who went through the wall, and they never got into the embassy. But three Marines held off these 26 guys. They didn't report this. This was not reported by the PBS documentary. They showed this problem, but they didn't give the context. You could call this whole documentary, Vietnam, a television documentary in search of context. And at the end, you could say, it lost. Not the problem of the political war in Vietnam, but the documentary lost. It never found the context. Now, I want to say something else that there are people in the room.